honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a special focus this week on Iwo Jima, the battle memorialized by perhaps the most famous photograph of all time, and a larger-than-life statue in our nation's capital that recreates it. At this time 79 years ago, that flag had just been placed atop Mount Suribachi, but the battle was far from over. We've met quite a few Marines over the years who were wounded on that small volcanic island, and you're going to hear from two of them before we conclude the program today. Jesse Arney did his fighting in a tank on Iwo, and he found out firsthand how problematic that volcanic sand could be.
Well, you had to be real careful, because if you turn too sharp, you'd put that wake at sand up and under the tracks, and it'd get stretched out to be too tight and bust to break the track. So we'd go straight out. They went straight out after we got the tank out and went straight out till we get up far. We could kind of make a slow turn.
This may seem like a silly question, but I think it probably gives us some perspective. What were your sleeping arrangements on Iwo Jima?
On Iwo Jima, I slept mostly in the tank. You could dig down in about 10 inches and put your canned beans and stuff like that down in there, and it'd heat it for you. But anyway, to sleep out, I slept under the tank a lot of times, and that's what, could get away from it, because the heat in the tank.
Did you get desensitized to the guys around you being wounded or killed?
It bothered you, but you couldn't let it stop you. You just had to keep on doing your thing, because everybody depended on everybody. And I was one of the best gunners that they had. And there's another one, and another outfit was he was good too, but we were the best gunners they had. I usually hit what I shot at.
But they're shooting at you too.
Oh yeah, but that's all right.
And, we're talking about Iwo Jima, and you say the words Iwo Jima, and the first thing that comes to people's mind is that flag going up atop Mount Suribachi. I've talked to a lot of guys who say they saw, there were two flags, first flag and second flag, but I've talked to a lot of guys who say they saw one or the other. Do you remember seeing that?
I was aboard the hospital ship. Yeah, if I remember right, I was aboard the hospital ship. They put that up on my birthday, February the 23rd. I was aboard the hospital ship, and when our tank got blown up, it killed the driver.
Let me back you up there a little bit. I know you ran over a landmine, but tell me what you guys were doing that day. What led up to that moment? And maybe walk me through that entire sequence.
Well, we was moving up to the front, getting up in the front. And we was making a charge. We was getting ready to cross the airstrip. Well, they'd planted that, whatever it was, and we hit it, run up on it. So the gunner, the loader, and the tank commander got out of the tank, and the driver was dead. The assistant driver was in bad shape, and I was out cold and had a gash on my chin. And they left. They didn't even check to see if I was dead.
So, sorry for all the questions. I'm trying to get the picture in my mind. So you guys, you're crawling along in this tank trying to move up to the front, and you're riding in the turret?
Yes. But it's closed.
So the turret's closed, but you're up near the top.
Gun, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you feel the explosion?
Yeah. And I got knocked out. To see the guys down below, they are more dangerous or something like that than we are, because we're all kind of above that. When it did that, I got this, I guess, from being knocked around in the turret. And I had my leather tank helmet on, but I don't know what happened. It wasn't on. And I got this big cash here. And so these two guys got out and didn't even check to see if I was dead or not. I was just out. Yeah, he didn't like me anyway, and I didn't like him. The tank commander was second lieutenant.
So this explosive device that you hit, did it flip the tank over?
No.
So it exploded and just...
It hit the front part of it, uh-huh. Hit right over where the driver was sitting. Well, you could feel it, but it didn't turn it over or nothing like that. Mm-hmm. But it did blow a track off, and it did kill a guy. But us guys up in the turret, we didn't have to worry about that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. because we had to worry about the people shooting us with a big gun.
So the tank commander and the loader get out. The driver's killed, the assistant driver's wounded, and you've got a gash in your chin from getting rattled around, but you're unconscious. So when you finally came to, where were you? What were you seeing? What were you hearing?
When I came to, I didn't take no stock of anything except that I was by myself in there. And so I just got out, and I went right out the top and dropped down beside those two tank commander and the loader. I dropped down right beside them. And another tank come up behind us, and they dropped their escape hatch, and we slid in under the tank and got in it, and they took us back to the first aid station. Then I went aboard the hospital ship till I got tired of it, and they lobbed a big old shell over the bow of the ship, and I said to myself, you can't swim 3 miles, so you better. So I told them, I said, I want to go back to my outfit. So they did. They sent me back, and you know, I don't remember going back, but I know I did. And then when I got ashore, I don't remember getting back to my outfit, but I did. And so my tank commander, he said, they put your tank, that's your gun on top of that tank. Said, you got to man it. Well, he was a tank commander, but he didn't man it. He didn't get in it. But anyway, I said, okay, what you can say. And so I got in that, and we was going along there. And tanks are so big, they just run over stuff. So I seen this box sitting out there. It must have been about 12 by 12, 12 by 11. Anyway, a little square box about so big. And I thought, So I shot it. It blowed a hole, and that's about almost big enough to hide that tank in it. Yeah, and our driver was headed right for it.
So if you hadn't seen it and shot it, it might have killed all of you.
It would have tore us up, yeah. Yeah.
While Jesse Arney was wounded in the first week of battle, an 18-year-old Marine named Carl Berghofer made it nearly a month into that five-week fight before earning his Purple Heart.
About 10 o'clock in the morning, we were making an advance through the last, up toward Catano Point, was the last hold out of the Japanese troops. We were advancing. It was a beautiful morning. That morning, we had brought us out the new sea rations. We enjoyed a good breakfast. Then they ordered us to move out, and we moved out to L Company and I Company combined, and we had about 20 men left of the two companies, and we made an advance across this. There was a series of ridges and flats and ridges and flats. We went from one ridge to the other. Finally, we came to a ridge, and we were blowing foxholes close as we went, dropping grenades at them. It wasn't a shot fired at us. We came up on this little ridge, and we raised up and looked over it, and I was one of the persons to look over it. It looked like a mushroom field. Japanese helmets, wow. And all of them had a rifle pointed at me. And I raised my legs up, and it took me 10 minutes to fall to the ground, and there was just a sheet of bullets came across the top of that ridge. The only way we could fire without getting hit was raise the rifles over his head and empty them in the general direction. And we threw all the grenades we had, and order finally came down for us to withdraw. And there was a flat area behind us and a big rock. So they started running one at a time, zigzagging and getting behind this rock. And I was about the fourth man through. The third man that went through, man, they really opened up on him, but he made it safely. And I made it about 3 jumps from that rock, and I got hit in the back of the head. I didn't know I got hit. Of course, I was knocked out. And I came to, I was laying on my face, my nose hurt. I thought I'd pull it and hit my nose on a rock. Then I felt the blood, and one of the guys behind the rock said, Berghofer, you're still moving? And I don't remember answering him, but he said, if you can make about 3 jumps, I can grab you and pull you behind this rock. So I laid there a minute and got my equilibrium back, and I got to my feet, and he reached out and grabbed me.
Wow.
And I evacuated myself back to base hospital. When I got back to the base hospital, I was treated by Dr. Raybont, and he was a surgeon from Santa Fe.
How about that?
I met with him several times after the war.
So what was the extent of your injuries?
I got a bullet hit in the back of my head. It was a glancing blow, but it pulled out a little piece of bone. He treated it and put a plate in it. It was supposed to have been silver, but I don't think it was. But it's since disappeared. It's been absorbed.
So you get hit. It knocks you unconscious.
Yeah.
You're lying on the ground.
Yeah.
They still have a line of sight on you, right?
I was still on the ground, so they quit shooting at me.
Right, because you weren't moving, they stopped shooting.
Yeah.
If you had been moving, they probably would have shot you a few more times.
Yeah, they would have shot me again.
So it's a good thing you got knocked out.
Yeah.
Maybe saved your life.
Yeah.
And then you come to, and you don't know what happened.
I didn't know what happened. I thought it had hit my head on a rock.
Because when you fell, I'm sure you did hit something.
I broke my nose, I know.
Broke your nose.
And I thought that was where the blood was coming from, but then I realized it was running down the side of my head. Head wounds bleed real bad.
And so it penetrated your helmet and the liner?
Yeah, it went through my helmet in one side and out the other. Knocked a little 25 caliber hole going in. Some of my friends brought the helmet back to me on Guam. When they came back.
So when you're in the hospital recovering, they show up and give you the helmet?
I was in the hospital, and then I'd gone back to duty, and we were putting up the tents and everything for the Marines returning from Ebo. I was on duty already back on duty when they came back.
And so they gave you the helmet with two
holes
in it.
Yeah, I brought the helmet back, and I lost it somewhere in transit.
Oh, man. Well, again, I'm still just fascinated by this circumstance. You're 18 years old. You're shot in the head. You're unconscious. You come to. You're trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
And you know that the Japanese can still shoot you at any moment.
Yeah.
And your buddy's telling you, try to move over here and I'll grab you.
Yeah. He says, Berkover, can you hear me? And I must answer him somehow. He says, if you could make about two jumps, he says, I could grab you. So I laid there and flexed myself. I remember that. And then I got to my feet, or I don't remember where I got clear to my feet or not. Anyway, I got up where I could jump and made about two or three jumps, and he grabbed me and pulled me higher that rock. And the Japanese never did shoot at me.
But you knew you were going to be exposing yourself to that fire by jumping over there.
Yeah.
How far do you think you had to go?
About 6 or 8 feet.
So then you're able to walk and move fine. You just have blood coming out of your head.
After I got back there, they bandaged me up, and I evacuated myself.
You had to be in pain.
Those medical corps, when I'm telling you, they were great people. They were great people. They were going in unarmed. A lot of them were Navy.
Right.
Medical corpsmen attached to the Marine unit. I remember when they'd get a mass casualties, they'd borrow morphine. We carried a little pouch on our thing with it had a roller bandage and a pack of dressing and a tube of morphine and a sulfa.
Right.
In each one of your little packs we carried on our belt, on a cartridge belt. He'd go around and borrow morphine from different people in the sofa because they didn't have enough in his pack to supply all the needs. And then we'd send back and he'd get replenishments. So, and one of the duties I dreaded on Evo was stretcher bearer duty. We'd pick up the wounded, sometimes the dead, and we'd carry them back to off the lines and back to a safe area. Sometimes clear down to the beach to the hospital ships. And the hospital ships, and they set up a tent field hospital on Evo. That's what I went to. But we'd carry, and we'd have two men to a stretcher. We'd put a man on a stretcher, and we'd run from one rock or foxhole to the next and dive in the hole. We were under fire at that time. And we'd get them back out of the firing area, and then we'd carry them down to the beach. And on the return trip, we'd pick up water and gasoline from flamethrowers and extra ammunition and grenades and carry the loaded stretcher back to the lines. The stretcher duty was a hard duty. But I was on stretcher duty about 2 to 3 times a day.
And then, so when you get hit and you get yourself back to the field hospital.
Yeah.
And you told the surgeon from Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Put the plate in your head. Did you think you might get to go home?
I didn't think so at that time. But at that time, they didn't know about subdural hematomas.
Hmm.
Where you get a blow on one side of the head and the bruising is on the opposite side. And I suffered from severe headaches for months over my right temple. And actually, they were bad enough where I passed out a couple of times. And I was finally, after they dropped the atom bombs on Japan, I was immediately back to the States and given a medical discharge.
Well, I've got to ask you, too. I mean, the situation where you're digging that spot out and you set the rock up on the edge and you said you were a tenth of an inch away from being killed there.
Well, maybe an inch.
Maybe an inch.
If he'd been an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
How about when you got hit? What do you think the margin was there for you surviving versus getting killed?
Well, looking backwards now, in hindsight, I would say I had a 50-50 chance.
Because if he's a little lower, he could sever your spinal cord.
Without getting hit. And I had a good chance of being wounded.
I mean, I'm just thinking, if a bullet hits the back of your head, it's not very far from ending it for you right there.
Yeah, if he'd have let me just a speck more, he'd have caught me. He didn't realize how fast I was running.
I guess that's it.
Yeah.
How often have you thought about that over the years? Because now you've lived another...
I still have dreams about that. Every once in a while, I have dreams about that damn place.
The men who were there never forgot it, and we shouldn't either. 79 years after the Battle of Iwo Jima, the uncommon valor displayed there as a common virtue represents the highest calling that a new generation of military men and women pursue today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.